We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. The terrorist attacks of 9/11 left many people asking the same question. How could a country with as much capacity for intelligence gathering as the United States fail to catch these terrorists before they struck? And certainly there was a good deal of conversation on this very point afterwards, and a number of problems were identified. And they included things like the inability of our various law enforcement and intelligence agencies to work together, the unwillingness to share information, and also the fact that they just simply didn't have enough people to do the real work of gathering intelligence, kind of the old-fashioned activity we might call spying. Well, our guest for the program this morning, Amy Ziegert, says that those problems that were identified after 2011 had really been problems that were of long standing, and they were the kind of things that for years people in Washington had been talking about and writing reports about, and that things really didn't change. Her argument, and it's an argument that she made in a book that was published a couple of years ago, a book titled Spying Blind, her argument is that organizations like the CIA and the FBI failed to change in the way that they needed to after the Cold War to meet the new emerging threat of terrorism. And I think that she would argue that, in fact, still to this day, the kind of changes that have been made simply aren't enough. We'll try to talk a little bit about that if you'd like, by the way, to read her book, Spying Blind. The subtitle is The CIA, the FBI, and the Origins of 9/11. It is published in paperback by the Princeton University Press. I'm sure that you can find it. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. Amy Ziegert is associate professor at UCLA's School of Public Affairs. She's a fellow at the UCLA Burkle Center for International Relations. She is also a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. She teaches courses on a number of things, including national security policy and U.S. intelligence. She has been featured by the National Journal as one of the 10 most influential experts in intelligence reform. She also worked on the Clinton administration National Security Council staff in 1993. She's joining us by telephone. And questions and comments are welcome. Again, as I like to say, we really hope people will be brief. And we ask that so we can get as many callers in as possible and keep things moving. However, of course, people are welcome as long as you're on topic and you could try to be brief. Please take the opportunity to call. Join the conversation. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Ziegert, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And you?
Good. Thanks for having me today.
Well, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. I'm certain that in the years after 9/11 of 2001, I've asked a number of people the following question and think all along about the same answer, and I think I know the answer I'm going to get, but I'm going to ask it anyway. And we can talk in some detail about things that have changed, how the structure of intelligence has changed. But if we ask this question, are we today better organized? Do we operate better? Would we be in a better position today to anticipate and prevent these attacks than we were in 2001? What would the answer be?
I think this year, for the first year since 9/11, the answer is not a categorical, we're not safer than we were before. We're better than we were. I hasten to add, we started from a very low bar. We were very poorly organized before 9/11. I'm sure we'll get into in detail some of the organizational problems we had. We're better in some real sense than we were before 9/11, but we have a long, long way to go. I look at the balance sheet as sort of three big gains, three enormous weaknesses, and two areas where it's too soon to tell or we just don't know enough. On the plus side of the balance sheet, there's been a lot of discussion in the past year that Al-Qaeda Central has really been degraded by, in particular, U.S. Predator attacks in Pakistan and Afghanistan. In terms of our intelligence, we are working better together. We have a new National Counterterrorism Center that is fusing threat reporting. We didn't have that before. And there have been some real analytic innovations in CIA and with the new Director of National Intelligence, including a website or a social networking site called A-Space, which is basically the classified equivalent to Facebook for analysts, which is pretty impressive, I have to say. So those are all improvements. Three big gaping weaknesses still. Our 16 different intelligence agencies of the federal government still don't operate as a unified team to the degree that they should. That's problem number one. Problem number two, the FBI, and we can talk a lot more about that. The FBI has failed to transform itself to a domestic intelligence agency. And the third big problem, which may be a surprise, is Congress. Congress is the least reformed part of our intelligence establishment, and the only major 9/11 Commission recommendations that have really gotten no traction at all were the recommendations to improve congressional oversight of intelligence. Two areas where we really don't know enough: hiring heritage Americans with those language skills and cultural knowledge, and then our human intelligence collection efforts. It's just really hard to say at this point how much improved they are.
I think that the thing that's really striking, you make the point in the book, is that if you look at the kind of studies that were made of the structure of intelligence after 9/11, and you look at the problems that were identified, and then there were some recommendations made. If you, as you do, look back to the years and the number of years between the end of the Cold War and 9/11, you find there's a stack of reports that came out of study groups and commissions that were essentially identifying the same problems and also making recommendations for reform. There, hundreds and hundreds of recommendations were made. The thing that you point out is that only a fraction of those recommendations were implemented, and they were the ones that actually were the easiest, the least problematic changes to make. The big, important, fundamental ones, things that were recommended over and over again, were never enacted.
That's right, and that's one of the most astounding things that I found. I spent 5 years researching this book. So on 9/11, I knew that this was the topic that I wanted to investigate, and I spent 5 years tracking down every major unclassified report from think tanks, Blue Ribbon commissions, and the government that analyzed intelligence and counterterrorism from the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991 to 9/11. And you're absolutely right. I found a dozen of these major high-profile studies and task forces, and they issued 340 recommendations for intelligence reform. And then I spent 2 years actually tracking, I call it the E. Hollywood true story, reforms from the 90s, where are they now? I tracked what happened to all of those recommendations. Only 10% of those 340, just 35 recommendations, were implemented. And those were sort of study the problem more recommendations. The vast majority of those reforms, 79% of them, produced absolutely nothing. And I mean nothing, not a phone call, not a memo, not a meeting. And if you then look at what the 9/11 postmortems found in Congress and in the 9/11 Commission, they found exactly the same major problems that all of those studies in the 1990s found. So we were aware of these major weaknesses in intelligence before 9/11. Intelligence officials were aware of them. Policymakers were aware of them, and we failed to get the reforms that we needed before 9/11.
Yeah, and one other, I think, basic point I think it's important to make is that some people have said, again, after 9/11, they say, well, yes, certainly this was an important failure, but they would say something like, the problem here that we're dealing with, an international terrorist network like Al-Qaeda, is something that's really, it's diffuse, it's really hard to get a hold of. It is not the kind of thing that we're used to dealing with. And while that is perhaps true, and the way we fought and, you know, what kind of war we're preparing to fight may be one of the issues. But again, I think one of the points that you make is that in fact that the intelligence community, as far back as the mid-90s, was right on top of it. What they were saying, you know, they were issuing threat assessments about terrorism. And they were right on target and were very consistent in what they were saying right up until 2001, and terrorism was on that list. And so you can't say, well, we really weren't quite sure. We really didn't know the nature of the threat. You would say, no, actually, the people whose business was to do this, they'd had a pretty good idea what the threat was. They were right, and they were saying that, and we just weren't paying attention.
That's true. And a second thing that I found that really was extraordinary, I think, is I do in my book, I have case studies of the CIA and the FBI and the internal reform efforts that they tried during the 1990s. They were well aware of the growing danger of the terrorist threat. And perhaps the real tragic story here is that they tried desperately inside George Tenet, inside CIA, and Louis Freeh inside the FBI, or various members under him in the FBI, try to reform those organizations to better adapt to the emerging terrorist threat. And they failed, for some systemic reasons. It's much harder to affect that kind of major organizational change, particularly for organizations that really were constructed to deal with the Cold War threat. So they were stuck in Cold War structures and Cold War priorities and Cold War mindsets and cultures, and those are very, very difficult things to change, and we're still struggling to change those things today.
Yeah. Our guest, let me just introduce again, our guest is Amy Ziegert. She is associate professor at UCLA's School of Public Affairs. Her area of interest as a scholar includes national security policy and U.S. intelligence, and she is the author of the book, has been out now, I think, was it 2007?
2007.
2007 when the book came out and is still out and available. You might want to look at it. It's published in paper by the Princeton University Press. The title of her book is Spying Blind, the CIA, the FBI, and the Origins of 9/11. Questions welcome 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, I wanted to go back and perhaps talk a little bit more about the things that have been done, the efforts we have made at restructuring these things. Where you say there were some gains, there are still some weak areas and some things we don't know about. One of the things that happened was we now have someone who, at least in title, is supposed to be the one person who has oversight over all of the various intelligence gathering organizations of the country, the Director of National Intelligence. I think perhaps before, people might have assumed somehow that the head of CIA was that person, but head of CIA was not that person. So we now have someone doing that, and the argument was that would lead to better coordination and that the various elements here would work better if there was somebody who was kind of responsible for that. So has the creation of that person, now that we have a Director of National Intelligence, what sort of difference has that made?
I'm really concerned about the creation of the DNI, and I think it gets back to some of the fundamentals of how the intelligence system is created. So the CIA director, the CIA was created in 1947. The CIA director was, in 1947, given two jobs. The first job was to run CIA, and the second job was to be the person in charge of all of the existing intelligence agencies in the military, in the State Department, and in other departments. So there have been about a dozen of them before 9/11. But what happened was that the CIA director could never actually do both of those jobs very well. And the reason he couldn't do those jobs well is he didn't have the authority to do those jobs well. So my first book that I wrote was actually about the origins of the CIA. And what I found was that there was real political maneuvering then, as there is today, by intelligence agencies to keep central intelligence agency capabilities weak, because they want to protect their own turf, their own budgets, their own power. So the CIA was hobbled from the very moment it was created. And we see many of those same problems playing out today with the Director of National Intelligence. And the big reason why is that 80% of our intelligence budget goes to Pentagon intelligence agencies. So the big agencies in the Pentagon that we hear a lot about, the National Security Agency that does wiretapping and code breaking, the National Reconnaissance Office, which builds and maintains our spy satellites, These Pentagon agencies absorb 80% of that budget. So it's very hard to wrest control over those agencies and put it anywhere outside of the Pentagon. And we're still grappling with that problem today. Many people believe that the creation of the DNI has only replicated the problems that the CIA director had before him and has, in fact, added yet another layer of bureaucracy in our intelligence establishment. Yeah. So if you're the president and you're trying to figure out what is the terrorist threat today, where do you call? Do you call the director of national intelligence? Do you call the CIA director? Do you call the head of the National Counterterrorism Center? It's not clear today who exactly is in charge.
I also have read some things about the fact that maybe there has been some friction or some throwing of elbows between the man who is the current director of national intelligence. His name is Dennis Blair. He's a retired former admiral. And Mr. Panetta, who is the current head of the CIA, which also raises this question, the reality is that the people who run these various agencies, nobody is going to cede power to anybody else. And I'm sure that it's very difficult for people to take orders from somebody else. And so the question would be, well, not just how do these agencies that are supposed to be parallel manage to work with one another, but how do they feel about the fact that now there's this guy who is supposed to be their boss?
That's right. There are a lot of turf battles. Turf battles die hard in Washington, as you know, David. And we see this playing out particularly in the Obama administration because it's the first presidential transition with this new intelligence structure. Right? The DNI was created at the end of 2004. So this is the first time we've had a transition to a new administration with the Director of National Intelligence and the CIA jockeying for power. And so we've seen a lot of friction between these two agencies. The latest that has become public, as you allude to, is this question of who's going to be in charge of the stations abroad, intelligence stations abroad. Does the DNI get to say who that person is, or does CIA? Now, in reality, of course, CIA is the agency that fills most of those positions, but there's been a big battle over that issue, and there's been a second major battle over who does interrogations in the U.S. government. And so we see power being eroded from the Central Intelligence Agency. As one former intelligence official put it, they refer to the CIA now as the agency formerly known as Central. So that's a real question mark as to how much of that erosion is a good thing or a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Telephone number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That was good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. If you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, Amy Siegert. She's a professor, associate professor in the School of Public Affairs at University of California, Los Angeles. She is an authority on intelligence reform. And questions again here are welcome. We have somebody ready to go. We will talk with them. Someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Just an observation as a citizen who's not informed about what you've been talking about other than sort of vaguely, and what you're saying is really discouraging. But when 9/11 happened and afterwards, I began to think, why didn't people act on this? When Condoleezza Rice said, who had any idea anybody would do this? I thought to myself, I've seen that the two Columbine killers had planned, if they had managed to pull off what they were doing, they had planned to then hijack an airplane and fly it into the World Trade Center. And I thought to myself, too, years ago when we got our first computer, there wasn't a whole lot of software for it, but there was something called Flight Simulator. And there's now a whole big flight simulation community that enjoys doing this. And you can even get background information on little tiny airplanes in places like Nepal. But I can remember not being very good at it and flying my little plane into the World Trade Center and thinking, oh, my goodness, if I could do this, at the time, I forgot about it. But if two teenagers in Colorado are thinking about doing this, and it's public knowledge, and there's this whole community of people who've played around with flight simulators and as klutzes flown their planes into buildings, Where was Condoleezza Rice? We need some people, in addition to all this other stuff, to brainstorm about what the average person might know, you know? Anyway, just a thought. Maybe it has no relevance, but I've been wanting to say this to somebody for some time. Thanks a bunch.
All right. Well, you react to that?
I think her thoughts have great relevance, actually. It's a great question about, you know, why couldn't we see this coming? And let me give a couple of thoughts, answers to that. The first is that we really did not have tactical warning. We did not know the time, place, and manner of attack. As George Tenet, the CIA director, had said, the system was blinking red, but that's very different than knowing where and when the attack's going to happen. That said, what I found in my research was that I identified 23 different opportunities that the CIA and FBI had before 9/11 to potentially penetrate the plot, and they missed every single one of them. And they didn't miss those opportunities because there were stupid people. And they didn't miss those opportunities because of the Clinton administration's failure to capture bin Laden or the Bush administration's failure to put terrorism higher on the priority list. The reason our intelligence agencies missed every single opportunity to penetrate that plot was that they failed to adapt to the end of the Cold War. And let me just give you one of the 23 examples to kind of give you a sense of how we tied our own hands organizationally. 19 days before 9/11, the FBI got word, finally, from the CIA that a man named Khalid al-Madar, one of the 9/11 hijackers who flew Flight 77 into the Pentagon, was probably in the United States and needed to be found, and that he was a suspected high-level terrorist. So the FBI starts a manhunt for Khalid al-Madar 19 days before 9/11. But the manhunt is not national. It's given to only one office, and it's given to the C team. It's given to one of the least experienced special agents in the New York field office, a man who had never led this kind of intelligence investigation before and had just finished his rookie year. Now, why is that? Oh, and one other thing. It was given the lowest level of priority. Now, why is that the case? Well, if you go back and go through it, you realize that the FBI's structure, culture, and incentives all made it likely that this person was not going to be found. The FBI manhunt was given to only one of the FBI's 56 offices because that's how every single FBI case is assigned, to one field office. There was no mechanism in place for ensuring that the manhunt would be nationwide. Why was this given such a low level of priority? Because in the FBI before 9/11, all intelligence investigations were given lower priority than criminal investigations. So preventing a future tragedy took a much lower priority than convicting someone for a crime that had already occurred. And why was it given to this inexperienced investigator? Because he was an inexperienced investigator, finding a potential terrorist to stop a possible event was the least desirable assignment. So it was given to the lowest person on the ladder. So all of these things made it highly likely that Khalid al-Madar would not have been found. Now, it's possible that a full-scale effort wouldn't have found him anyway in just 19 days, but I have to tell you, the evidence is very tantalizing. Khalid al-Madar, we now know, and another 9/11 hijacker, lived using their real names in San Diego. They lived for a while in San Diego before 9/11 with an FBI informant. The FBI did not know this. They also made contact with several targets of FBI counterterrorism investigations in the United States before 9/11. The FBI did not know this. And perhaps the most disturbing piece of evidence that I found in my research was congressional testimony from an FBI special agent where he said that on the night of 9/11, he was so distraught, he sent the name of Khalid al-Madar to the FBI's information technology database to see what a search of public records, not classified, what a search of public records would uncover. And he got al-Madar's correct address in San Diego within just a few hours. So this man, I believe the evidence suggests, could have been found, but the FBI was not structured, cultured or incentivized to be able to capitalize on this opportunity. And I found the exact same thing in 22 other cases.
Well, just real quick, and I have some other calls to go on to, I think there you put your finger on one of the weaknesses that was pointed out then, and something that you identify as a continuing weakness, that is the FBI, is really, it's really a despite all of its sophisticated resources, it's a conventional law enforcement organization. They, for all of their existence, thought their job was to go after people that had committed crimes and catch them. You know, they were into breaking down doors and arresting people. And this kind of problem, it requires a completely different orientation, a different set of goals, maybe also different tools. So the question is, now at this point, has there been much change in the way the FBI operates so that they would be better able to deal with this kind of problem?
Well, I think, David, you've hit it right on the head, which is that this is really a new mission for the Bureau. The Bureau has been traditionally very good at its principal mission, which is fighting crime. And so the question of preventing a future attack requires a completely different orientation. It's about connecting information across cases, not pursuing individual cases. It's about a proactive future orientation, not about a reactive past orientation. And it's about working quickly to forestall catastrophe, not carefully and slowly to gather evidence for a court. So very, very different business. How well is the FBI doing? Not very well, to be honest. Let me give you three big problems that the FBI faces today. The first is incredibly high turnover. The number one spot in counterterrorism at the FBI has been held by 8 different people in 8 years. You cannot sustain change, this kind of change in an organization, without sustained leadership. That's a big indicator that there's a real problem here. Second major problem, for the FBI to be an intelligence organization, it has to treat analysts like first-class citizens, and it doesn't. There's an old joke in the Bureau that there are only 2 kinds of people, special agents, the people who carry the guns and the badges, and furniture. Analysts have never been considered first-class citizens, and they still aren't. No analyst can run any of the FBI's 56 U.S. field offices. In fact, one analyst complained bitterly to me that the head of intelligence at the FBI is not an analyst. It's a special agent, a former special agent. So that's a huge problem for the Bureau. They've hired a lot of analysts, but getting special agents and analysts to be co-equal partners in intelligence analysis is a long way off. And then the third big problem, which we saw before 9/11 and still see, information technology. Director Mueller announced shortly after 9/11 that upgrading the FBI's archaic computer system would be one of his top priorities. We are now 8 years later, and we've spent several $100 million, and the FBI still has a system where you actually have to hit F3 or F4 using 1980s technology to access case files online. They are nowhere near where they need to be in terms of technology. And as one analyst recently put it to me, I don't think we'll ever get to where technology is a core competency in the Bureau. And that's very discouraging.
We are a bit past our midpoint here. I'll get right calls in a moment. Let me introduce again the guest, though, for anyone who might have just tuned in. Amy Ziegert is associate professor at UCLA's School of Public Affairs, and in her work is interested in U.S. national security policy and U.S. intelligence. She's been featured by the National Journal as one of the 10 most influential experts in intelligence reform, and she is the author of the book Spying Blind, the CIA, the FBI, and the Origins of 9/11. It is published in paperback by the Princeton University Press. So you can find the book in the bookstore, I'm sure, or the library. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone here where we are in Champaign County. Line 2. Hello.
Hi. Operations is another facet of all of the intelligence outfits, and I know many people diminish it, but and the fact that it hasn't come up yet, and the fact that operations can influence, intelligence. That a lot of times, intelligence serves policy. We've seen that in other instances, not so much 9/11. So that's I don't know whether you'll address that satisfactorily, in my opinion, but since it hasn't come up, but privatization is another another problem, in my opinion. A recent scholar on NSA, you know, agreed that it was a great problem on these airwaves, but it had no sense of the scale of how much it is. We have this $9 billion corporation, SAIC, which I think had a fair amount to do with the aforementioned FBI computer fiasco. So it seems to me when the profit motive is introduced, a lot of things can go screwy in this kind of realm. There's what's the market for intelligence? But I had an anecdote as well, if I might, and this has to do with the history and perhaps legacy of the FBI from the early Hoover days. I mean, there's no question about it that Hoover was investigating people to get things on him and to do that kind of thing. And the fact that at the time of 9/11, there were five or six agents, special agents, high-level guys, in New Orleans investigating a high-priced call girl ring, it seems to me that with the track record that we've had for the Bush administration, I know you're a Clinton partisan, so maybe you'll feel uncomfortable commenting on this, but they were probably looking for stuff to get on people. And that is a dimension of the problem that I have no reason to way to fathom. I mean, the fact that the governor of Alabama was basically railroaded makes one think, in the way the whole prosecutorial system of the Justice Department was manipulated, makes me think that there's probably a lot of ugly stuff under the rocks.
Well, let me take your points in reverse order, all of which are just excellent points. You clearly, David, have a lot of intelligence junkies in your audience. I try very hard to be an equal opportunity critic, and I've also worked in the Bush administration 2000 presidential campaign. So I think there's – and one of the – if you take anything away from my book, I hope what you'll take away is that it's a lot more complicated than blaming individual administrations. I wish the answer were that easy, because if that were true, then our intelligence problems could be solved by the ballot box. But I think the problems are much more serious and deeply entrenched than that. The FBI, you're absolutely right, on 9/11 did not devote a great deal of resources to counterterrorism issues. And in fact, the FBI in 1998, so 3 years before 9/11, actually wrote this incredible strategic plan, which identifies counterterrorism as its number one priority. And this document, which took me a great deal of effort to get, is remarkable and remarkably forward-thinking. And so they get it, right? There are people inside the Bureau that are working furiously to try to adapt to this threat. Yet, if you look at where are the resources on 9/11, more than 90% of FBI personnel were working issues other than counterterrorism on 9/11. And one of the favorite factoids I uncovered in doing research for my book was that new agents on 9/11 received more time for vacation than counterterrorism training. And an internal Justice Department review found that two-thirds of the FBI's own analysts shortly after 9/11 were rated unqualified to do their jobs. So even though the Bureau as an organization identified this threat, they didn't match their resources to combat that threat. Now, I think we have a difference of opinion about why that is. I don't think it was that they were digging up dirt on individuals for political gain. I think those Hoover days are past. I do believe that. But I do think it's a question of an organization is very hard to change, and that criminal prioritization, that criminal mission, was one that even though the Bureau said they needed to change it, it didn't happen before 9/11 because it's hard for anybody to change what they do. So that's the first point. The second issue you raised had to do with operations. And I assume by operations you mean covert operations abroad. Covert operations are a part of every administration. Every president has used them, Democrat and Republican. But what we found before 9/11 was that, again, the CIA was trying desperately to have inroads in Afghanistan and did not make a great deal of progress before 9/11. Now, why was that the case? Well, in part, it did have to do with the peace dividend of the 90s, where the CIA's workforce was gutted by 25% during the 1990s, and we're still living with the legacy of the 1990s today. We have the youngest intelligence workforce in our country's history, 50% of people in the intelligence community were hired since 9/11, and it takes a long time to ramp up those capabilities once you start cutting people. And that gets to your third question. Great question about privatization. Hard to get your arms around that because it's hard to get the data about what's going on. But it's pretty clear that there's a tremendous amount of outsourcing of our intelligence capabilities to beltway bandits, as they're called, or retired intelligence officials who get paid a lot more, frankly, when they retire and go work in the private sector. I know that the House has recently found that 60% of the Department of Homeland Security's intelligence people are private contractors. 60%. And that raises a number of accountability issues. How do you actually monitor what they're doing? How do you hold them accountable if you're a government agency or if you're a member of Congress? So we're just beginning, I think, to get a handle on the severity of the problem and the nature of the problem. But you're absolutely right. Outsourcing is a major issue in intelligence today.
Yeah. Again, I want to thank the caller. I really need to go on here. Next caller is in Montgomery and on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, great information, but there's a lot of skeptical people like myself, and I'm starting to believe this. They knew that this was going to happen ahead of time because I had a friend of mine who happened to work there said for some reason there was this notice that don't come into work today. That was one notice flowing around where it could have been far worse than it was. The second one is that the place was hit once before, which I kind of find it funny to believe that – you know, they wouldn't go for the financial district again. I think, to be honest with you, there's so many. There's NSA, there's the CIA, there's the FBI. Why can't they just come up with one organization and screw the rest of it? Because it just makes me angry that people had to die unnecessarily because of the lack of, you know, the whole thing. You're bringing out a lot of good stuff out there. The people of this country needs to know how slack our country is in trying to protect us. And I really, really, you know, we have this idea that we're going to want the government to take care of us. This is a good example why we don't want the government to take care of us. I'll get off. Thanks.
Well, I think the caller raises a fair point about the fact that we do indeed have all of these different agencies, and he mentioned FBI, CIA, NSA. There's one within the Pentagon that's kind of similar. There are something like, I don't know, 14, 15 of them. Do we really need all of these different agencies, and would some kind of consolidation be either a good idea, or you would have to say, well, it might be a good idea. I don't know if we can do it. But would something like that be important or possible even?
You know, I talked to many people in Washington, both in the executive branch and in Congress, and to a person, I think they would agree that if you were to take out a clean sheet of paper and design an intelligence system today, it would not look a lot like what we have. What we have is an accretion of all of these different agencies, probably too many of them. And of course, the irony here is that whenever there's an intelligence failure, the natural response is to create a new agency to do what we failed to do before, right? So when in 1952, as a national security agency, since 9/11, we went from 12 to 16 federal agencies. And if you think, as I do, that the principal problem before 9/11 was coordination, creating more agencies doesn't make a lot of sense. In addition to that, we have now a proliferation of fusion centers across the United States. So I used to joke that we were an intelligence system that was all spokes and no hub, and now we have too many hubs. So this question of, you know, how many agencies do we have and isn't it too many, the answer is we do have too many, but it's going to be impossible to consolidate them.
All right, to Effingham. This is line three. Hello.
Yes, my perspective comes from the Arab side. The people allegedly involved in this and their motives and the reasons why they would have executed something like this if they truly did. And all I ever heard from the Bush administration and the many other commentators was that they just hated us. Well, for everyone who hates, there's motive. And that's my question. Thank you, and I'll hang up.
Well, I don't know. Is that something that you can talk about?
talk a little bit about it. I think it raises the question of how do you combat the terrorist threat over the long term? Intelligence is the first and last line of defense, but we have to tackle that demand side of the problem. How do we stop more terrorists from filling the ranks of Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups? That's a very tough question. There are a lot of different theories about it, but one theory that I would like to argue has been really debunked by social science is that poverty is the root cause of terrorism. Lots of great studies by economists and political scientists show categorically no real causal connection between poverty and terrorism. So there's something else going on. I think we haven't quite gotten our hands on a policy to tackle that demand-side long-term problem. But intelligence alone isn't going to do it.
All right. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Amy Zeigart. She is associate professor at UCLA's School of Public Affairs, and in her work is interested in looking at U.S. national security policy and U.S. intelligence, and she is the author of the book Spying Blind, the CIA, the FBI, and the Origins of 9/11, published by the Princeton University Press. One of the basic points that you have made is that big bureaucratic complex organizations like the FBI or the CIA, and I'm sure that it's true of others in Washington, they're very resistant to change. And your basic point is that that's been the big problem, and that is that the CIA, for example, or the FBI, we're still in, from the end of the Cold War up until 2001, we're still in the Cold War mode of operation. And the problem was that they failed to adjust to the change in threat from the Soviet Union to a group like Al-Qaeda. So one of the things that we wanted to at least take a little bit of time and talk about was the CIA and about how things worked in the CIA. We now, since at least the beginning of the Obama administration, we have a new director, Leon Panetta, who is not someone who comes out of the intelligence community. He was very much an outsider. And I wonder, so far, has there been any significant or interesting change in the kind of personality or the mode of operation of the CIA?
I haven't detected a major change in CIA. I think Panetta is trying to be a forceful advocate for the CIA to Congress, and to some extent that effort has backfired when he went to the Hill and testified about this program that to assassinate Al-Qaeda, or targeted killings of Al-Qaeda leaders abroad. That seemed really to come back and bite him. I'd love, David, if I could, to get to this question of why is it so hard for these agencies to change?
Sure.
And I think there's a really important point here, which is that it's not just government agencies. All organizations have a hard time changing on their own, even private sector businesses. So we often lament that government isn't run more like a business. What I found is that businesses often aren't run like businesses. But what happens in the private sector is that if you don't adapt, you go out of business. And the difference in government is that if you don't adapt, you still stay in business, but you stay in business and you sort of limp along, and that's what we find. And there are three real reasons, three major barriers to adaptation for our intelligence agencies. The first is no organization changes easily on its own. I don't care whether you're a restaurant or a Fortune 100 company or the CIA, it's just hard to do. The second has to do with the political incentives of everybody in the system. Presidents, for example, don't tackle intelligence reform. No president since Harry Truman, Democrat or Republican, championed intelligence reform before 9/11 because it's a political loser. If I were to poll your listeners and ask them how many of them voted for their member of Congress or their president based on the views of intelligence reform, I bet the answer would be very, very few. It's not a political winner at the polls. And then the third enduring barrier to adaptation is our wonderfully fragmented democracy. In our system of separated powers, major changes require legislation. And as we see just in the healthcare reform debate this week, major legislation is always a very difficult thing to pass, and it requires compromise. And when you're talking about creating or reforming an agency, compromise is a dirty word because it lets the opponents of reform have a say in the outcome. So you let the fox into the hen house. And that's what happens with the design of our intelligence agencies. We sabotage them at the outset because legislation requires compromise.
Yeah.
So those are sort of the enduring barriers that make this problem such a difficult one.
All right, let's talk with another caller, and this is someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, you may not have time to talk much about this, but I think it's useful to compare our system, say, to another one like the British, the relation between MI5 and MI6 and whatever else there is over there. I really don't know much about it. But can you have a word or two to say about that in a couple minutes?
Well, I'm going to give you a very disappointing answer, which is that's such a great topic, I decided it was too big to do in my last book, so it's a future book. I think the comparative perspective would be very helpful. It took me 5 years to research this one book, and I just didn't get to it, but I think it's a very useful and important question to ask.
All right. Well, we'll save that for another day. Just for a moment, I'm interested in coming back to Mr. Panetta, and I don't know how much you know him or know about him. I think it's interesting that here we have someone who he was in Congress for a long time. He then was the chief of staff in the Clinton White House, and then, much to I think a lot of people's surprise, he was selected to head CIA. And it seems like almost immediately there was this conflict between Mr. Panetta and the Director of National Intelligence. And then more recently, we're reading stories about conflict involving the CIA and Mr. Panetta and the Justice Department surrounding things like, you know, rendition and aggressive questioning of suspects and other sorts of things the CIA has done. And it seems that very quickly that Mr. Panetta, rather than, you know, throwing the doors wide open, has really become part of that agency and very strongly seems to be concerned with protecting the agency and the agency's turf.
I think that's right. You know, I have to, you know, full disclosure here, when Leon Panetta was announced as the nominee for CIA director, I was pretty critical. He had never shown any interest in intelligence. He never served in 16 years in the House. He had never served on the House Intelligence Committee. And I found it bizarre that at the same time we're undergoing an economic crisis, we say that our economic appointees have to be steeped in the industry, but the head of the CIA doesn't need to have a bit real background in intelligence, and I thought that was really misguided. I think intelligence is an issue that is extremely complicated, and you can't get up to speed by reading a briefing book once you get into office. It's an insider's game, and it takes years to master the intricacies if you really want to ask the smart questions and get the right answers. And I think that we see with Panetta, but that said, I will say, I think Panetta quickly realized that the CIA has to be strong for our intelligence to be strong. And some of these battles he's getting into are battles he should be fighting to protect the agency and enable it to do its job. You know, Mike Hayden, his predecessor, had a wonderful speech where he talked about using every inch of the operational space that the president gives the agency. And I think Panetta is in some ways continuing in that tradition. He might object to being put in the same category as Mike Hayden, but I think that what you find is any CIA director takes seriously the obligation to protect the country by using every inch of space that he has and not going beyond it today. And I think that's an important thing to underscore. The big flap recently about interrogations and the Inspector General's report, which was declassified, really showed that the CIA, even in the Bush administration, was operating in the space the president approved. And so for those who have issue with those policies, renditions, interrogations, detentions, the real question is about the Justice Department and the political officials that said these things should be done, not the agency that carried them out.
And just for we have about a minute, maybe two, to get back to this idea of failure to adapt to the post-Cold War era, I think one of the points you've made is that what we've done is, for example, we've, in terms of intelligence gathering tools, that we've spent tremendous amounts of money on things like spy satellites, which are great. They will do a lot of things for you, but it doesn't give you the proverbial boots on the ground, and that one of the problems that we've had is what comes under the heading of human intelligence, the things that I suppose the guys that people, for want of a better word, we would say spies. You know, people who go out, they do investigative work, they do undercover work, they actually go places where we're trying to gather information and go and try to find that out. Are we doing any better in recruiting and putting resources into developing those kind of people?
I'd like to say the answer is yes. I know the CIA is trying very hard to recruit people with the cultural familiarity, the language skills to be able to do that. It's a very hard target. It's too soon to tell. George Tenet was blasted when he said it would take 5 years to rebuild the clandestine ranks of the CIA. I think he was being way too optimistic. It takes many more years than that to develop those capabilities. And so I think that's one of those areas where it's too soon to tell.
Yeah. So just as a final, I guess right at the beginning, you said something like, well, it would have been all that long ago that if you asked the question, are we safer now than we were, you'd have to say no. Your answer now is, well, there has been some progress, but it sounds as if we still have some way to go.
Yes, I think that's you summed it up quite well, David.
Well, at that, we will say thanks to our guest, Amy Ziegart. She is associate professor at UCLA's School of Public Affairs. She's also visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford and is a fellow at UCLA Berkel Center for International Relations. She's an expert on U.S. security policy and intelligence. And if you'd like to read her book, the title is Spying Blind, the CIA, the FBI, and the Origins of 9/11. It's published by the Princeton University Press. It's available in paperback, so you can find it in a bookstore. And Professor Ziegart, we want to say to you, thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
Well, thanks so much for having me and reflecting on 9/11, about 9/11 today.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Champaign Park District. The Champaign Park District and the Champaign-Urbana Symphony present Symphony at Sunset to kick off the 50th anniversary of the CU Symphony at Dodds Park on Saturday, September 19th. There'll be an instrument petting zoo, entertainment, and food vendors before the concert at 7 p.m. More information is available at the Champaign Park District site. That's champaignparkdistrict.com. Programs here on WILL are also made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffees, breakfast featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., and to-go sandwiches and salads for lunch. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall at the corner of Gregory and Goodwin in Urbana. We'd just like to remind you that if you're interested in going back and hearing some past programs from Focus 580 or from the Afternoon Magazine, you can also hear a lot of the news features and things that our news staff produces. All of that is available on our website. In addition, there's other information on programming on WILL radio and television, so you might take a look at it. It's WILL, that's W-I-L-L, will.illinois.edu. We have a big archive of past Focus interviews, and if you like, in real time, you can listen to our programming through your computer. That's all at will.illinois.edu. And that's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine, and sitting in today as the host of the show is Tom Rogers.
Good afternoon, David, and good afternoon, everybody. Let's tell you what's going to be on the Afternoon Magazine in the 1 o'clock hour. We'll be talking about bees, a bit of a change of subject. We'll have an archived interview with Celeste Quinn and Susan Brackney, a nature writer and master gardener and the author of Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. Stock markets and commodity markets are working hard today, and it's a lot of red on the commodities, especially with the USDA reports that came out with a slightly higher soybean crop expected. That's driven prices down almost underneath $9 a bushel in the November contract, though it's bounced back up a little bit. September wheat in Kansas City right now is at $4.56 a bushel, down 6.5 cents. December down a penny at $4.72.5. September wheat on the Board of Trade in Chicago down 6.25 at $4.26.5. December, though, up a penny and a quarter at $4.60. September corn is at $3.03 a bushel, down 6.5. December, $3.11.5, down 3.75 cents. March down 4 cents at $3.24.75. In the energy stocks, crude oil taking a beating, $69.33 a barrel right now, down $2.61. RBOB gasoline at $175.1, down five and six tenths. Soybeans for September, the contract is up 3 at $9.76.5, but the November is at $9.02.5, $9.02.75, down 23 and 3 quarter cents now. January at $9.09 and a quarter, down 24 and a quarter. March